Well, we got up to slide 8 so far. I haven't talked about 8 yet, but I mentioned a little bit of what's going on in 8. We're looking, obviously, here at a cartoon of just a phospholipid bilayer, not a complete membrane, because there's more than just phospholipids. But if you think about just the phospholipids that make up the bilayer, as we were talking about before, it's a fluid mosaic because the individual phospholipids are not covalently bonded to each other. They're just held in place because of their avoidance or non-avoidance of water, as we discussed. So they're free to move in various ways with respect to each other. It's not very likely, though, for this transverse diffusion to happen, this so-called flip-flop, where a phospholipid that's in one monolayer moves into the other monolayer. And that's because doing that would require, at least for a short amount of time, the polar head to be in the hydrophobic interior of that membrane. It does happen every once in a while, though, you know, a few times a month, maybe. Whereas the lateral diffusion and the rotation, this is happening much more often. Lateral diffusion refers to the fact that these phospholipids within one monolayer are trading places with each other. They're shuffling around like the heads of a crowd, as I mentioned before. That happens millions of times every second in a membrane. So just always remember how dynamic really all parts of the cell are. They're not just built and put into place and ignored. They're always moving around. Well, one way that we can demonstrate this fluidity is demonstrated in slide 9. If you coat a cell with fluorescent dye molecules, which is what the little green dots represent, then, of course, they will fluoresce, and you'll see the surface of the cell glow. Use the right kind of microscopy. And if you then use a laser to bleach one little area of the cell surface, basically just destroys the ability for that of that dye to fluoresce. So you don't it will appear as a dark spot, as you see in the picture below, because everything else around it is still glowing. If you do that, what you notice is that that dark spot fairly quickly goes away. And the reason it goes away is not because the fluorescent molecules regain their ability to fluoresce. What's happening instead is that things aren't staying put in that membrane like we just talked about. There's this lateral diffusion of phospholipids that are still attached to fluorescing molecules that are coming in and taking the place of the ones that can't fluoresce. So the area quickly becomes fluorescent again because there's migration of phospholipids into that area. Just one of several ways that you can demonstrate actual fluidity of the membranes. It's not just a theory. Okay, now to 10. Using a calorimeter, it's possible to measure the so-called transition temperature for membranes. The transition temperature is when, kind of like the melting point, in a sense. They go from gel-like state, more rigid, to a much more fluid state at a particular temperature. Well, the reason that you would want to make that measurement is just to put a number to the fluidity of the membrane itself. We already talked about the fact that cells are able to adjust that fluidity based on what the current conditions are. And how do they adjust that? Or what are the things that actually determine the fluidity of the membrane? Yeah, the amount of saturated versus unsaturated fatty acids that are part of those phospholipids that make up the membrane, and which makes for less fluid membranes. Well, I heard both answers, only one of which is correct. Saturated fatty acids pack together more tightly and therefore make it more solid, more gel-like rather than fluid. And that's all you're seeing here on part B experimentally. This is the cell before they messed around with, or the membrane. Whereas if they enrich it in 18 to 1 oleate, now 18, that 18 to 1 ratio symbology means that there are 18 carbons in that fatty acid, and the 1 means that there is a double bond there. So that means it's what kind of fatty acid? Unsaturated versus 18-0 means same chain length, same number of carbons, but it's saturated because there aren't any double bonds. Maximal number of hydrogens, in other words. And this is just giving you evidence of what we just said. If you have a bunch of unsaturated fatty acids, the 18 to 1s, in that membrane, it has a lower transition temperature. It doesn't pack together as tightly, and therefore it's looser, which means it has a lower melting point or transition temperature. Whereas if you enrich it in ones that are saturated, it's stiffer, higher transition temperature. Well, that is one thing that does determine fluidity, its degree of saturation of the fatty acids. It's not the only thing that matters, though. What you see in the graphs in slide 11 is that the chain length of the fatty acid also matters. So remember, there's really no limit to the number of carbons you can add to a fatty acid, because all you're doing is making more carbon-carbon bonds, an additional one every time you add a carbon, there's another carbon-carbon bond, and you fill it up with hydrogens. You can do that as many times as you want. But most cells have fatty acids of around 18 on average carbons in their chains. The left part of the graph, though, the lighter orange bars here, show you that as you have shorter and shorter fatty acid chains, fewer and fewer carbons, that is, the transition temperature goes down. All right, so that means they are what, stiffer or looser? Looser as it goes down. So it's not only the degree of saturation, which is shown on the right, it's the actual size of the fatty acids as well. And they both are contributing simultaneously, of course. But notice from the differences from bar to bar that saturation or unsaturation has a greater effect than chain length does. On the right, they were all 18 carbons, so all of these were exactly the same size, but it shows you number of double bonds. So it's saturated first, monounsaturated, polyunsaturated with 2, polyunsaturated with 3. The more double bonds you put in there really drastically affects the fluidity, much more than the chain length. They both contribute, though. That's the point. Well, no big news in slide 12. This is just a cartoon showing you what we've been talking about today and last time, that when you have the double bond, that forms a kink in what would otherwise be a nice straight hydrocarbon tail of a phospholipid. So the hydrocarbon tails of a saturated phospholipid, which is one that has nothing but saturated fatty acids attached to it, can get very close to each other side by side. They pack together very well. Those kinks, though, mean that they have to be more spaced out, and that's what makes that overall membrane more fluid, if that's the case. Well, we mentioned sterols as important components of membranes for all organisms, not just animals. It's just that what type of sterols are used by species differs, right? So we animals have as our chief sterol cholesterol. Anyone know why it's called that? Did I already go through that? Yeah, bile solid alcohol is what it literally means. Coal is bile. So cholesterol is a component of bile, but it's also a very important component of all of your plasma membranes. And what did I say cholesterol's main job in the membrane is? Right, it's a fluidity buffer. And so, compared to a membrane that didn't have any cholesterol in it, one with cholesterol won't change in its fluidity as much. That's what the buffering function means. So if the temperature drops without the cholesterol, that would make it much stiffer than it would with the cholesterol there. And if the temperature gets high, that would make the membrane much looser without the cholesterol than it does with the cholesterol present. So a given change in temperature doesn't make as big a difference to fluidity with a membrane that's embedded with sterol of some type. So we animals use cholesterol. What do plants use? Phytosterols, which come in a variety of different phytosterols. What about fungi? Hopanoids are for bacteria, chiefly. Ergosterols, yes. Right. They all really serve the same function, though. They're just different molecules that different huge taxa of organisms use. Well, in slide 13, we can see, for the case of cholesterol, why cholesterol fits nicely into a membrane. Cholesterol is mostly nonpolar. It's mostly hydrocarbon. But it's an alcohol, right? Which is why it ends in OL. So it has a hydroxyl. And that hydroxyl, because the oxygen of that hydroxyl is hogging the electrons, that makes the hydrogen of that hydroxyl slightly positive, right? Just like the hydrogen of a water would be. That hydroxyl is a perfect place for a hydrogen bond to occur between the hydrogen of the hydroxyl of the cholesterol and the oxygen at the carboxyl end, or the connection end, of the fatty acid. Where the fatty acid connects to, what are these three carbons indicating? Glycerol. If they were by themselves, this would be glycerol, right? That's where the connection is made with the fatty acids, at the carboxyl group. Well, the oxygen of that carboxyl is slightly negative. The hydrogen of the hydroxyl is slightly positive, and therefore there's a nice hydrogen bond that holds that thing in place. And the three-dimensional rigidity of this ring structure is what really affects the fluidity. So there's quite a bit of cholesterol, actually, up to about half of the lipid content of a typical animal membrane is cholesterol. So it doesn't really look like it in that cartoon, but there's a lot of cholesterol there. Okay, now to 14. And what we're looking at here are what are called lipid rafts, as you see labeled, which were discovered, well, we're still learning about them, actually. Even though we've known of their existence for quite a while, they're, compared to the overall membrane, it's a more recent discovery. Lipid rafts get their name because they are like little rafts floating in the overall membrane, moving around but staying as a collection, rather than just individual phospholipids, which you never know which other phospholipids they're going to be associated with. A lipid raft is a collection of lipids and proteins that more or less stay together. And what you can see from the bottom picture is that what makes them different from the surrounding phospholipids is that the lipids that make up the raft are usually longer chain fatty acids, have longer chain fatty acids, which is why they stick out from the surface a little bit. And then there are various proteins associated with the lipids. These, not only are these lipids longer chain, which decreases their fluidity, they also have a higher percentage of saturation than the surrounding phospholipids, and that also affects their fluidity. So these rafts are stiffer than the overall membrane that they're part of. And that's what holds them together, like a little raft, right? You have to lash together things to make a raft so that it doesn't just come apart. Well, these rafts, like I said, are associated with proteins of various sorts, which we're probably still learning the functions of. But one thing that lipid rafts seem to be really important for is organizing an arrangement of proteins involved in signal transduction. So receptor proteins and associated proteins that work for receiving a signal of some sort at least sometimes are associated with these lipid rafts. And it's a way, enzymes can be also associated with these lipid rafts. So certain things happen in a compartmentalized way, even though it's not compartmentalized like an organelle is. It means it's localized. A certain function is localized within the overall membrane into these rafts. This is another important point about membranes in general. You can have totally different things happening on different sides of the cell. It's all part of the same plasma membrane, but what's happening on one side might be totally different from what's happening on the other side. Yeah. Signal transduction. And we're going to talk about much more about signal transduction in a chapter that's devoted to that. Okay. Let's go on to 15 then and talk more about proteins rather than just the lipids that make up the membrane. Of course, proteins are an important component. And there's many different functions that membrane-bound proteins serve. What are some of those functions? What is it? There are many proteins that are signals, but those signals aren't membrane-bound proteins. Those signals are released by endocrine cells, for instance, or neurons, and they're therefore not part of the membrane. But what's involved? So that's not all signals are proteins, but many of them are. But what's involved? Right, the reception of those signals is necessary for those signals to do anything, to have any effect. And so a major function of membrane-bound proteins is to receive signals, to act as signal receptors. What else? Transport, right. Various things can get into or out of the cell with the help of a protein. These are things that wouldn't get through the membrane or through the lipid bilayer very easily. So transport proteins, yes, that's definitely a major function. There are some enzymes that are membrane-bound and that work just like any other enzyme that would be in the cytosol. They just happen to be part of the membrane. They're also important in holding cells together. Anchorage, cell-to-cell adhesion. And they're also important for cell-to-cell recognition, particularly what kinds of proteins? Hmm? No, I'm talking about cell-to-cell recognition, not signaling, really. I mean, it's kind of signaling, but... Yeah, glycoproteins are important in cell-to-cell recognition. So it's really not the different functions that's being illustrated here. For any given membrane protein, you can categorize it based on how it is associated with the membrane. All right, so notice that this whole big bracket on the left part, those are all what are called integral membrane proteins. An integral protein is one that is part of the integrity of the membrane itself. It's not just associated with one surface or the other. It actually extends into the depth, at least somewhat, into the thickness of that membrane. So notice that in all cases of these purple ones that are all listed integral membrane proteins, at least part of the protein is in contact with the hydrophobic interior, the tails. All right. Now, the simplest case is a monotopic protein. It's integral, but monotopic means that it's only associated with one of the two monolayers that make up the bilayer. And this brings up the point that any given membrane is polar, not with respect to charge. Polar just means that it has two different ends to it. What I mean by that is that the outside, the outer face of the membrane is not the same as the inner face. The two monolayers are not the same as each other. There's a different collection of proteins in each of the monolayers. So a monotopic protein could be anchored to the interior monolayer or to the exterior monolayer. It's just showing you an example here on the bottom, but the inner surface, it could be the outer surface as well. Anyway, a monotopic protein does not touch the other monolayer, just one of them. Whereas a protein that extends all the way through the membrane is called a transmembrane protein. So a transmembrane protein is another example of an integral protein. And the distinction here between the different transmembrane proteins is that you can have a single pass, meaning that one polypeptide weaves through it just once, through the thickness just once. A multipass will go back and forth. It's all one polypeptide. So it has, you know, the two ends that any polypeptide does, but it will weave back and forth through the thickness multiple times, at least twice, in order to be a multipass. But you can also have a multi-subunit protein, which is at least two polypeptides. It's a quaternary structured protein. They're all transmembrane, though. On the other hand, in addition to integral proteins, whether they're monotopic or transmembrane, you can have a peripheral protein. And this one, again, is showing it on the inner surface, but you could have it on the outer surface as well. A peripheral protein, though, is named for the fact that it's associated only with the periphery of the membrane, which is the edge. The periphery is the edge. So the peripheral proteins don't have any contact with the hydrophilic thickness of the membrane. They're just associated with the polar heads of one monolayer, just like you see on the green example here. See the difference between the green and part A? Peripheral proteins are not integral. Just loose associations. They're just skidding around on those polar heads. Then, of course, at the end, we have lipid-anchored proteins. Now, these are lipid-anchored because what you really have here is not just a protein. It's a lipoprotein. It's a protein that has covalently bonded to it a lipid. And it's that lipid part, because of its nonpolar nature, that holds it in the membrane. All right. So this is different also from part A, because the polypeptide part of this lipoprotein is not associated at all with the tails. It's the lipid part of the protein that's associated with the tails. But that's what keeps it in there. Doesn't keep it in that place, of course, because there's still lateral diffusion. So all these proteins are able to move around. Now, if you have a protein that's part of a lipid raft, they don't move around as much within that raft. But the whole raft is able to float around. Okay, now to 16. Well, on left, we're looking at a glycoprotein. We've talked about these several times, including just a moment ago. Glycoproteins are important in cell-to-cell recognition, and in some cases, cell-to-cell adhesion, because these carbohydrate components, the sugars that are bonded to the protein, can take on there's a lot of variability when you start adding different numbers of monosaccharides in different configurations. You have a lot of specificity, and therefore the carbohydrate component of these glycoproteins serve as identity flags that will allow another membrane-bound protein in a different cell to recognize that sugar component and say, okay, you're the correct type or whatever. This brings up once again what I just told you about the polarity of a membrane. If a membrane has a bunch of glycoproteins in it, effectively all of those carbohydrate components of those glycoproteins are facing the exterior of the membrane, where they have their, you know, that's where you put your identity badge. You don't hide it inside, right? So that's just part of the polarity. What's happening in one monolayer, what is there in one monolayer is different from what's in the other monolayer. On B, we have bacteriorhodopsin, which is just an example of a membrane-bound protein that we know quite a bit about. Just to give you an example, though, of the fact that when you have a multipass protein, that's a good way to actually make a little channel where there aren't any fatty acids around. In the interior of this multipass protein, if you are where the blue arrow is, in other words, you are completely surrounded by amino acids, not by fatty acids at all. All right, and this is how many channel proteins and carrier proteins are made, by being multipass, frequently involving a bunch of alpha helices. But if you were looked, you don't see the detail here, but if you were to look at the actual amino acids that make up the helices, there would be hydrophobic R groups facing outwardly, which have no problem being around these tails and therefore keep this thing buoyed in the membrane. But there would be hydrophilic R groups on the sides of the helices facing the interior of this overall purple membrane. So you form a hydrophilic channel where things that are hydrophilic don't have any problem going into, where they wouldn't be able to penetrate through the hydrophobic thickness of the phospholipid bilayer. That's the rationale there. And why does the book bother to show you the C double bond O and the NH3 here? Yeah, just to show you that this is a polypeptide that's being represented by this purple ribbon, and any given polypeptide has a carboxyl end and an amino end. Okay. Now to 17. Well, when we make these glycoproteins, of course, that's not glycoproteins are not produced by translation, or it doesn't end at translation. Translation doesn't involve anything having to do with sugars, right? What is translation's job? Just to assemble that particular sequence of amino acids into a polypeptide, right? So a protein that is destined to be a glycoprotein eventually, first is just a protein. That's what translation builds. The sugars are then added to that protein after translation. And therefore, where do you expect this to occur? Not in the cytoplasm, no. Well, this is an example of a modification of a protein, right? Where do you expect that to occur? What organelle? In the endoplasmic reticulum, the rough endoplasmic reticulum, and to a lesser extent in the Golgi. That's where proteins that are not ready to work right off of the translation assembly line are put. Instead of making them out in the cytosol, some proteins are built so that they get strung into the lumen of the rough ER, which then modifies them in some way. Well, one way that they're modified, these proteins, is by sticking on a sugar. And the process of sticking sugars onto a protein to make a glycoprotein is called glycosylation. You're putting on glycosyls, basically, is what the word means, which are glycosyls are sugar groups. Well, there are two major ways that you can connect sugars to a polypeptide. And these are called N-linked and O-linked glycosylations. And what you see here is that the N, the nitrogen, involved in putting a carbohydrate group onto the protein for an N-linked, uses asparagine as the amino acid that has that nitrogen in it. Whereas if it's O-linked, you're not connecting it to a nitrogen, you're connecting it to an oxygen, specifically an oxygen of a hydroxyl. And it's usually either threonine, as you see here, or serine. Either one will do the job because they both have a hydroxyl in their R group, which is an ideal place to lose that hydrogen and make that covalent bond. Hydroxylysine and hydroxyproline aren't the normal amino acids. They're not of the 20 biological amino acids, but they're a modification of lysine and proline, respectively. So in some cases, it's those instead of threonine or serine. But in any case, you have either N-linked glycosylation or O-linked glycosylation, and this can happen many different times. So when you make a glycoprotein, it's not just one connection point. It's not one amino acid necessarily that has that sugar hanging off of it. It can be several different ones. And it can be different sugars hanging off of each of these different connection points. So there's all kinds of possibilities, and this is why you can have a very specific identity badge used for cell-to-cell recognition. Final slide in this chapter, 18, is just a close-up view of the lining of your gut to show you that in some cases, we have what's called a glycocalyx, which is a pretty dense collection of sugars in the extracellular matrix. That collection of sugars, which, you know, they're hanging off of proteins that are on the membrane. They're not just free sugars. But that collection of all the carbohydrate components forms a layer called the glycocalyx, which can be protective and also can be lubricating, as in the case of this one. These are, this is all one cell at the bottom, These aren't cells. These are microvilli that are hanging off the surface of the cell, increasing the surface area. What's the job of the small intestine? To absorb nutrients that have been digested from the food. That's when they finally get into your body. But that mass of, it's no longer called food at that point, it's chyme, but that mass of stuff that's traveling through the small intestine would rub the hell out of this. So the glycocalyx is protective not only for that reason against abrasion, but also is protective against invaders, because some of the bacteria that you eat by the millions each time you swallow aren't killed by the stomach. Many are, because it's so acidic. Some make it to your gut and could cause you problems there. So it's also protective in that case. But it's also holds mucus. These cells produce mucus, which gets trapped in the glycocalyx, and it makes it smoother for things to pass by. All right, that's that chapter.